Thanks a lot, Surya, Kevin, for inviting me. Justin too, I guess. So it's great to be at Perimeter and speaking about some work that I've been doing. So this is some stuff that I've been thinking about for some time, but my understanding is still very, very poor. So this is, for the most part, it's work in progress, and there's still a lot of things that I need to understand. But I thought I would explain the basic idea that I have about these things. So the point is that there's like this chain, this three-tier sort of hierarchy that seems to be there. So that's how I'm going to organize my talk. So the first thing I'll review is going to be some very old stuff. So this is witness formulation of Morse theory, which was worked out in the early 80s. So I'll spend a couple of minutes just to remind you of how that works. After that, I'll move on to the next step, the second floor, so to speak, which is slightly more recent and also slightly less known stuff. This is some 2015 work done by Gyotamur and Witten. And so finally, so after reviewing that, I'll argue that there's a third floor, which has to do with the Hyperkähler manifolds and their moment maps. So this is the newer stuff. So that's how I plan to structure what I'm going to say. So let's begin with the very old stuff. So Morse theory. Is what I'm writing visible, by the way?
Yep.
So the very first piece of data, this so the setup for Morse theory is that so I need so in the formulation of Morse theory that is due to Witten, you need a Riemannian manifold. So it's important to have a Riemannian metric on my manifold X, and I also have some function, real valued function. And so the point is that to these two pieces of data, there is a theory. There's a sort of a one-dimensional cohomological field theory. And the way it's obtained is by sort of a, so there's a n equals two supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So in other words, so if I write down some standard type standard kinetic term, G A B phi dot A phi dot B plus fermions. So this theory, so phi is a map from R X. So this theory has n equals two supersymmetry, which means that there's some operators that are Q and Q bar that are nilpotent, and the anti-commute to the Hamiltonian. So I can use one of these supercharges as a BRST charge to get a one-dimensional cohomological field theory, meaning that in this field theory, the translations are Q exact. And so the question, so once you have this sort of thing, the question you ask is, okay, what, it's one dimension, so field theories typically assign spaces to codimension one manifolds. So you ask, what does it assign? So here, codimension one is a point. What does it assign to a point? So you have this one-dimensional cohomological field theory. What sort of linear space do I get? So usually I would expect to get some linear space, but now because it's a cohomological field theory, this linear space is going to have some extra structure. So first of all, it's going to be graded. And the grading is going to be by some ghost number, this integral grading. And the second thing is because I have this BRST operator, there's going to be some map from on the space, which squares to zero. So such a pair is a chain comp is as it has the name of a chain complex. So what I'm telling you is that okay, this what this thing should assign, what this cohomological field theory should assign to a point is some chain complex. And so the problem now is given this given this Riemannian manifold and a function, how do I build a chain complex? And so that's the setup for the Morse-Mill-Witten complex. Tell you how to do that. So this has a sort of two key building blocks. So the first, in order to build this vector space known as the Morse-Mill-Witten complex, let me call this continue calling it V. I need the data of the vacua, which is the same as so critical points of H. So these are points in X. DHP equals zero. So I'll make the usual assumptions, which means that there are finitely many and isolated and non-degenerate. So I have some finite set of critical points. I'll build a vector space freely generated out of these things. And so as I said, this should be a graded space, and the grading, the ghost number of each critical point, I'll set to be the Morse index. So what this is of Pi, so this is the same thing as the, so I have some symmetric matrix, the Hessian. I look at this at the critical points, and I look at its signature, and I look at the number of negative minus negative ones that it has. So that's by definition the Morse index. So this is my vector space as a graded vector space. So far I didn't use the metric at all, and that's where the next step comes in. The next step involves looking at instantons between these vacua. So the instantons come in, so there's a one-dimensional ODE for maps from R to X given by the flow, gradient flow by B tau. Local coordinates looks like this. I want to study gradient flows between different critical points at infinity. So at minus infinity, I say P. Plus infinity, I go to another critical point Q. And then sort of some index theory says, it says that if the Morse indices of Q and the Morse index of P differ by one, then there's a well-defined integer count. So there is this is defined to be the signed number of flow lines, gradient flow lines between P and Q. So in other words, if the Morse indices of these critical points satisfy the right selection rule, then there is a well-defined integer. And this is an integer that I'll use to define the second piece that I need to specify a chain complex. So I'll define the differential to be the sum over all Q such that the ghost number is bigger than the ghost number of P by 1. I take the integer NPQ and I multiply it by EQ. So this gives me at least a well-defined linear map of degree 1. But then, of course, I need to check that it's a differential. So finally, the final step is I need to check whether Q squared equals zero holds. And so this happens because of a famous argument that repeatedly enters. So this is known as the broken flow line argument. So I won't go through it in great detail, but the basic idea is I look at So now I study moduli spaces of instantons where the ghost number differs not by one, but by two. So that is going to give me a one-dimensional space, and I'll look at its ends. And once I do that, I'll find that the ends sort of exactly correspond to the right terms that I need in order to show that this quadratic identity in the integer integers that count the rigid instantons holds. So that's sort of a lightning summary of sort of what happens in the Morse complex. So there's this one-dimensional cohomological field theory, and it leads to this chain complex. And so this chain complex has interesting topological invariance properties. For instance, up to homotopy equivalence of these chain complexes, it will not depend on. So the homotopy class of these chain complexes will not depend on the metric. So there's topological properties. So there's G independence. There's also also independence under sort of small deformations. So it's independent under like the right kind of deformations, compact deformations of H. You have this chain complex, which is sort of capturing topological properties of your underlying pair XH. So that's the that's my summary of the Morse complex. Before I go on to the next stage, does anyone clarifications? Okay. So now let me move on to second floor. So this was super basic, if you're familiar with this. So in the next stage, I will now complexify things. So essentially, take the previous setup and complexify everything. So my manifold now is going to be a Kähler manifold. This is the metric, and this is the integrable complex structure. And now I'm going to look at a certain class of functions on this thing. Holomorphic. So now I look at Kähler manifolds and holomorphic functions on them. And so now the point is that there is now D equals 2 field cohomological field theory. So where this comes from is the fact that in two dimensions there's not this, there's a real non-cohomological field theory known as the N equals 2, 2 Landau-Ginzburg model. So this has four supercharges with some supersymmetry algebra. So I can choose the sort of what's known as the A model, which is the A model in my talk, refers to a certain linear combination of these supercharges. Which is nilpotent. So I use this as my sort of twisting supercharge. And so this twisting, I treat it as a BRST charge, and I get a two-dimensional cohomological field theory now. And then I ask the same question that I did before, which is, so it has enough supersymmetry to be like fully extended. So it makes sense to ask, what is this field theory assigned to a point? So because you are doing now two-dimensional field theory, you expect now not some linear vector space, but some linear category. And so because this is a cohomological field theory, the right sort of thing that you get here should be some chain level lift of a category. So the right thing that you get is you expect infinity category. If you know, you don't know what this is, I'll define it in a bit. So given Taylor manifold plus a holomorphic Morse function, how do you build this A infinity category? So that's that was addressed by some mathematicians in the early 2000s, is my understanding. But it was sort of reformulated in the way that I'll describe by, as I mentioned in my outline, by Gayotra Morewitten, maybe a little less than a decade ago. So that's what I'm going to describe next. So the GMW recipe, or an A infinity category. So this is a kind of an interesting recipe. So it has two steps as far as I understand things. So the two steps essentially involve, there's a hard part and an easy part. So the hard part of the story is that you need like the what I call like the BPS. You need some building blocks. You need some information about the spectrum. So some BPS. You need some information about some BPS objects. I'll say what that means. And then so the second thing is there's a combinatorial framework. That sort of combines these things, combines them into this algebraic structure. So let me go through these things one by one. So what are the building blocks? So these are the things that you need to know. So you can treat them as sort of inputs, but so really, if you're given a Landau-Ginzburg model, if you're given like a Taylor manifold and a holomorphic function, so there's some these are the sort of objects that you would require if you had any hope of building an A infinity category. So there are now three of them. So it's similar to how if you want to build this Morse-Witten complex, you need vacua, instantons. Here there is something is going to happen in the middle. So the first step is, again, I need vacua. See, there are points in Y now, such that the superpotential, the critical points of the superpotential. So I want to make the same assumptions that I make about this, meaning I want to assume that all of them are.
So I wrote a question, actually. In the 82, in Witten's 82 paper, of course, he does a more general case, I'm sure you know about, where he does handle the Snell case and not just the Morse case.
Yes.
He has to spend some time thinking about super Hilbert spaces to do that. Is the sort of analytic stuff available in the one dimension up, or do we really need to be in the Morse case?
So, as far as I know, no one has really worked out like the more general case where you have like non-isolated, where you have like some positive dimension manifolds of critical points.
Even in the Morse case, is it just an infinity category, or could I get some like Hilbert type or C star type structure too?
Could you explain the additional structure that you're talking about?
I don't know what the answer would be. I mean, that's
I don't know
what type of thing to ask for. I remember that, you know, when Witten's deriving,
yes,
the narrative he tells in this famous paper, he writes down the actual quantum mechanics and then,
yes,
starts studying, you know, as an analyst studying solutions to differential.
Yes, equations. Yes. So right. Yeah. So these things that I'm writing down here, when I just throw this chain complex that freely generated by the points. These are really, you should think of it, them as a physicist, you should think of them as like perturbative wave functions peaked at these critical points. And so that's like that's the sort of thing that will happen in all these that's the sort of picture you should have in mind in the higher dimensional stuff as well. These Hilbert spaces have some they have some inner product. So you know these elements generated by critical points are give you some natural orthogonal basis and so on. So
I guess I'm asking is there an inner product? Are there some Hilbert spaces?
Yeah. So it's going to be the same sort of thing where things are sort of generated by some critical points of some appropriate functional, and then you know those things will naturally give you an orthogonal basis. So it's I guess maybe the point is that the Hilbert structure is sort of built into the construction when you like build these. Thanks for the question. Some important assumptions I want to make about this is so now I want everything to be massive, but I also want to assume that the critical values are in general position, meaning so if I plot these critical points, real W and W, I want all of them to be distinct and sort of any three of them should form some triangle, like they should not be in some degenerate position. So that's an important assumption as well. That's just the first vacuum data. The second are what I call BPS solitons. So here I'm going to write down an actual sort of some analog of a Morse function now. So consider in order to say what BPS solitons are, I'll consider the space X to be space of maps from R to Y. Let me write down a function on this space. So zeta, let me fix some zeta in on the unit circle. So this thing, this scalar manifold has a symplectic form, and let me write it as locally as some primitive of some Liouville form. Dx, x is a coordinate here. So now I'm going to use this. I'm going to do sort of Morse theory of this function to get two additional layers. Anytime I have a Morse function, I have these two sort of layers. So now I'm going to look at the critical points of H. So by definition, a BPS soliton is a critical point of now this H that I built. So it's a critical point of the symplectic action functional, where the Hamiltonian is the imaginary part of W. So this gives me some equation. It's similar to this gradient flow equation. I want to look at sort of what's called a PQ soliton, meaning at minus infinity, I approach P, and plus infinity, approach Q. So the main point is that because I built this out of critical points of a function of a Morse function, of a real function now, I can build now a vector space. I have to tune this zeta to be a certain value over absolute value in order to get a solution. And so under projection to W, these things will sort of connect critical values by some straight line. So you can call these BPS solitons. You can also call them just BPS segments, because that's what these things are, literally, if I project this map under W. So the point now is that there is a now a graded vector space, which I call RPQ. So for every sort of classical soliton, PQ soliton, I assign. I assign a one-dimensional space, roughly speaking, and it's graded by some. There's a way to grade it in a natural way by looking at the sort of second derivative and regularizing it. So the point now is that the second sort of thing I have here is that for every pair of vacua, there is now a graded vector space known as the space of VPS solitons. So indeed, the space comes with a basis, which you can think of as an orthogonal basis. The third thing that you can consider, which is sort of the really new ingredient that you need to build this category, are what I call VPS polygons, or you can also call them VPS junctions, or you can also call them zeta instantons. So there's a differential equation. The differential equation is obtained by applying the gradient flow equation to this infinite dimensional Morse function. So this gives you an equation for a map from R2 to Y now. And it looks like the following. So I let tau and x be coordinates here. So if I apply gradient flow to that above function, I get this sort of equation. So this is known as the zeta instanton equation. It's also known as the Witten-Delbar equation. And so there's a certain type of solution that I want to look at for this two-dimensional equation now. The solution looks like the following. So I go to the W plane. So I let P0, Pn be a collection of vacua, such that their images, their critical values, are in convex position. So here's a five gon. I have five critical points. So that's the next thing is that I want to label edge by a soliton by P0, P2, etc. And so on. So I have this collection of solitons living on the edges. And so what I want to do is I want to look at sort of solutions that under projection to W sort of fill out the interior of this polygon. And so the boundary condition at infinity, so I have this plane, x tau plane. Maybe I should draw it here, so it's more visible. X tau plane. At a large circle at infinity, I want this solution to sort of become like this broken. I want the circle to sort of behave like a set of broken flow lines that I labeled here. So the picture in this plane is then that these sort of that there's this sort of picture in the x tau plane. So because of this side of things, that justifies the name that this is a VPS polygon. And because of this picture in space-time, this justifies the name that this is some junction of solitons. Right, is this clear? So I'm looking at solutions of this instanton equation that sort of looks like as this sort of structure. And so
so I have view car P doesn't have not equal to Q necessarily. So the critical point for P equal Q is not a critical point for HS pi.
I didn't understand. Trivial?
Trivial.
Oh.
Yes.
The trivial map between sorry, repeat your question?
Yeah, so I'm wondering the VPS soliton is the statement about VPS soliton being a critical point of HS phi.
Yes. I mean that's just the trivial the constant. You mean the soliton being where
a lot of soliton being trivial.
Yeah, that's part of. So I mean, there's some redundancy in my description. So I mean, there's a subset of solitons that are just the vacua. Sure.
So in your RPQ, also you allow P equal to
V. Yeah. So if you like, yeah, RPP.
Yeah.
That's an important point. RPP is just one dimensional.
Yes. Yes. Sure.
Yeah. That's yeah, thanks. Why not?
I mean, you're not including lines that go between the points in itself.
Well, I mean, the constant map is always a solution, right?
Yeah, but it's not half of PS. Because there's all symmetry, not half of them.
Sure, but I mean, if it's full VPS, then it's also half VPS. I mean,
see any situation where it would be useful to define RPP to be C instead of empty.
What about, later I'm going to talk about brains, right? So when I'm talking about brains, it's certainly important that HOM between two thimbles is one. It's true.
HOM is precisely one.
Yes. I mean, okay, so that's, you can think of how to talk about the degenerate case separately. But I mean, it's true that there is a soliton, it's just the constant.
No, not two. A soliton has something that breaks a specific amount of supersymmetry, which is needed for all the counting to work. If you don't break the supersymmetry, then the counting doesn't work. The zero mode counting doesn't work.
Okay. Maybe. Okay. Sure.
Unless you flavor.
Unless you what?
Flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can have the.
Okay. Yeah. You're right. I mean, yeah. The closed loops are different. Different beast. So okay. Maybe the right thing to say is that you only want to consider like E and Q distinct. All right, so let's see. So I was gonna say that for each of these things, so if there's an appropriate selection rule satisfied by the gradings of the solitons, then there's a situation where there's a well-defined integer count. Which is sort of the, morally speaking, the number of BPS, sign number of BPS polygons or junctions between each of these vacua. There's probably need to do some work to make this index theory work, but let me skip that. These integer counts of each BPS polygon are the sort of third thing that I need to know. Okay. So now let me combine combine these things. So given the knowledge of these three things, the vacua, the RPP, and these n phi 1 dot 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 phi n 0, so the GMW combinatorial formalism. Is a way to build this A-infinity category. So in an A-infinity category, what do I need to have? I have some objects. E for every pair of objects. There's a vector space, graded vector space. And then there is a collection of multiplication maps, V, P0, P1. Of a certain degree. And then I wanted them to satisfy the an important set of constraints known as the A-infinity associativity axioms. So here, let me just give you a schematic description of what these maps are. Well, so, okay, so, So let me proceed step by step, sorry. So the objects of this A-infinity category are, so there's an object, LP, for every vacuum. For every critical point. And so before I say anything, I have to say that I need to choose an additional an additional piece of data to start saying what this category is. That is a direction, a point on the unit circle. So once I choose this point in the unit circle, this collection of objects gets an ordering. The ordering is given by sort of looking at the critical values and sort of projecting it to a line perpendicular to this direction. This gives me a natural ordering. And so the next thing I want to do is I want to define the Hom space V E0 GPQ. So this, by definition, is given by sort of taking a direct sum over over sort of this is given by a sum over PQ semi-infinite polygons. And then there's a vector space where this thing is built from tensor products of soliton spaces. So to see what I really mean here. So let's say my configuration in the W plane looks like the following: P0, P1, P2, P3, and I choose zeta to be this direction. So then, what is V P0 P3? Well, so I'm going to have to sum over all sort of polygons that go to infinity in this direction. And for every sort of finite edge, I will write down the corresponding soliton space. So this is one contribution. This is going to be another contribution. 3. This is going to be another contribution. So this is going to have a product of two of these things. And then the fourth contribution will be a product of these three spaces. So there's this sort of rule in order to say what the Hom space is between two vacua. And so, okay, these, another way of saying it is that you sort of, another way of remembering it schematically is that you sort of sum over, you can go to the dual of this thing, which is a picture in space-time. Etc. So schematically, that's the form of these Hom spaces in this category. So it's a, basically it's this direct sum of soliton spaces where you're at every where I sum over this the sort of bands. So this picture allows me to give me sort of like an interpretation that these things are really sort of boundary local operators. In space, in this quantum field theory between symbols LP and LQ, or at least the perturbative analogs. There will be some differentials on this space.
Sorry, maybe have you used somehow ordering over zetas here?
Which one?
Ordering over those zeta values, zeta pq. Here, right?
So you're right. Yeah. So I mean, so in order to define this space of solitons R, E, Q, I look at solutions of the soliton equation where this soliton, where the zeta in the soliton is fixed to be zeta P, Q.
Okay.
Otherwise, there are no solutions.
Okay.
With these boundary conditions.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, but I stress that this when I look at this. Category, then all of them are sort of there. So this is just depends on a particular zeta that is not any one of those. So that's why sort of I can sort of consistently look at products of these soliton spaces for different zetas. Hopefully that's not too confusing. And then so okay, that's my prescription for the morphism spaces. And then, so for the sort of most non-trivial part, here I can only be extremely schematic, but at least the pictures are clear. Was there a question? Okay. So the pictures that that are there when you define the A infinity maps are the following. So MK is roughly speaking a sum over taut webs on R plus times R with K boundary vertices. So if T is such a taut web, there's an amplitude for every web. And so what? So in order to say what such a thing is, let me just draw some of these things for you. So this is an example of a taut web with one boundary vertex. So such a picture would contribute to the M1. Oops, oh, sorry. And this is also a picture with one boundary vertex, and it's taut. Taut means that there's only the only modulus in this, the only sort of moduli in this picture are the overall scaling. So M2, this is an example of something that would contribute to M2. etc. And similarly for M3. And so the way I get the structure coefficient is that each of these internal vertices look like one of these domain wall junctions. So the amplitude of a web, or associated web, is given by the product over the internal vertices and for every vertex I multiply all the counts of these polygons that are dual to these pictures so I sum over all webs with these amplitudes products over internal vertices where I weight every vertex by the count of the BPS polygons, and that gives me sort of the structure constants of these maps. So I realize that it's sort of very quick, but the point is what I want to make concrete is that there's an explicit sort of prescription. If I know these integer counts, it's not too hard to figure out what these A infinity maps are. It's a totally combinatorial prescription. Let's see. Yeah, so the main claim of GMW is that these things satisfy the A infinity axioms. So this claim has this sort of status of a physics theorem, I would say. So they give good physical arguments for why. What does this actually mean? This is a statement. What this really is that it's a statement about these ends, right? So what they argue is that if you look at moduli spaces of these things, which are essentially one-dimensional, then there are only certain ways that it can degenerate. And they the discussion is sort of at the physical level of rigor, but no one has really sort of made it into a mathematical theorem yet. That will probably require lots of non-trivial analysis to actually show this. So this is sort of physics theorem. Okay, so I took this effort to describe to you, given a Taylor manifold and a holomorphic function, there is sort of this prescription to build some A infinity category. And so this thing is supposed to be an invariant of the pair of the pair YW. And so it enters in many, many different places, right? So it's sort of the one side of the LG Fano correspondence. In particular, it allows you to give like a fairly concrete description of like the bulk local operators. So that was sort of, in my understanding, kind of murky in the Fukaya-Saito description here. That's not quite the case. Now we're up to 2015. Are there any questions before I go on to the third case? All right. So the thesis is that there should be a third floor in the story. And the third floor has to do with the fact that the main thing is that now I will do sort of a further complexification. Now I let Z, G, I, J, K the hyperkähler manifold. And I consider now mu from z to R3 now. So I don't know if this is standard terminology, but let me consider a class of functions which I call hyper holomorphic. What I mean by that is that the derivative, so mu is written as mu I, mu j, mu k. So I want the derivative of mu I with respect to some direction in z to be j a b times the derivative of the kth component plus cyclic permutations. So there are two more equations. J, K, I, etc. So really, this is sort of a dumb way of describing. Another way of saying that I have this hyperkähler manifold with this sort of function is to just say that I have a hyperkähler manifold Z with a isometry, hyperkähler isometry generated by the vector field, by a vector field V. So there's a vector field which preserves the metric and the complex structures. And then so mu is a hyperkähler moment map for this vector field. So if there's an isometry, then there's a hyperkähler moment map which is hyperholomorphic in this sense. But then there's something in the other direction too. If I have such a function, I can build a vector field which is then going to preserve my hyperkähler structure. So this is the setup.
And is this the same as saying that you have you have your twister bundle of hyperkähler manifolds, and then you want like a holomorphic, and then you have like a certain line bundle on twister space, and you just want like some holomorphic map of bundles?
Well, I'm not sure how to phrase this moment map in the language of twister space, but I'm sure there's a way of doing it.
I'm just saying that no matter what complex structure you choose,
yeah,
you can always break your moment map into real and complex parts.
Yes.
So then you'll have a holomorphic function in each complex structure.
Yes.
And so you should be able to piece those together into some map of bundles over the twister sphere.
I was wondering if that is
all you need, or if there's like an extra.
So I haven't.
Your condition about the all these things in the cyclic permutation?
I mean, the best way that I know how to think of these things is to just say that there's a hyperkähler.
Yeah, but I know that those are an example. I'm trying to figure out if there are any other examples.
I think these two things are equivalent. So if I have this thing, I have that. If I have that, I have this. So it's an equivalent. Anything you can phrase in terms of hyperkähler isometries, continuous hyperkähler isometries, you can phrase in terms of these functions, I think.
Okay.
All right. So what's the physical theory? The physical theory is that there is a 3D n equals 4 sigma model with this target space Z and with the potentials determined by mu. These are the potentials, n equals 4 preserving potentials. And in this thing, I have a 2, 2 subalgebra, 2D 2, 2 subalgebra. And I have one such algebra for every point now in the twister sphere. I fix a point in this twister sphere, and I go to the 2, 2 subalgebra. And then within this, I pick the A-type supercharge. In this n equals 2, 2 algebra. So this gives me, and I use this as my twisting supercharge. So now this gives me a way to build like a 3D 3D cohomological field theory now. What does it sort of give you when you evaluate it on a point, morally speaking? There should be some sort of two category, just from general axioms of general considerations of topological field theory. And in fact, because I've done this at I have a cohomological field theory, this should be really some chain level version of this thing. Chain level version. Something you might want to call a homotopical two category or an infinity two category. And so even like the, to me at least, to my knowledge at least, the sort of mathematics is sort of it's not exactly clear what notion of a two category you should expect here. So that's part of the thing that we hope to answer by studying. If we're able to build such a two category, part of what we hope to answer is to say, okay, what exactly is this notion anyway, right? So the claim now is that there are only how am I doing on time, by the way?
We started like 5. We typically go for like an hour-ish, and we started like 5 minutes.
Okay, okay.
But it's not really a hard cut.
Okay, sure, sure. Thanks. Yeah, I'm close to the end. So now the point is that in this 3D field theory, there are sort of some natural. So the first step, remember in the first step in the GMW construction was to specify some natural class of VPS objects. And then there was some combinatorics, which allowed you to build a category. So one can certainly talk about some natural class of VPS objects. So let me say what some of those things are here. So I fix a VPS object in the A-twisted hypercalar sigma model. So I fixed some point now in the twister sphere, and I claim that claim is that the 3D n equals 4 theory is equivalent 3D n equals 4 theory with of this pair z mu is now equivalent to D equals 2 Landau-Ginzburg model, so on R3, with target space Y being maps from R to Z. Let me call the coordinate here Y. So this is a hypercalar manifold as well, just like Z is. So it has some complex structures. And then I specify an Now I specify some I zeta holomorphic function as follows on y as follows. So I let.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble parsing just the sort of.
Yeah.
I think are you telling? Is what you're doing? You're describing me the HOM one category between any pair of objects in your two category? Is that?
Not well. Right now, it's just a claim about theories.
I don't know. I mean, maybe this is my own ignorance, but I don't actually know how to parse a statement of the form this 3D theory is equivalent to that 2D theory.
Operationally, so what I've done is I've sort of taken one of the directions in the 3D and moved it to the target, right? So that's not very deep, but always, so I already did that, this kind of trick, and when I was talking about the real function that I wrote down to get the GPS soliton equation, right? So I wrote down this function. So there I was already viewing this 2D theory as like the 1D theory. So it's just some formal trick. It's not, you don't have to phrase things in this way.
Using it at the level of the Lagrangian.
Yeah, at the level of the Lagrangian. I mean, I was going to say that next. Like, concretely, like, if you just compute the Lagrangian, it's the same up to some topological terms.
Should I parse this as convectify along R?
I wouldn't say that because, like, if I just consider constant maps, if I consider the submanifold of Y consisting of constant maps, then it's compactification.
I think I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. I'm just saying I can view a 3D theory as a 2D theory with infinitely many fields.
So that's all.
Yeah. I fix a zeta, and I let omega zeta be the 2-0 symplectic form, holomorphic symplectic form on with respect to I zeta. And this is the form on Z. I write this locally as d lambda zeta. And also I let mu zeta be the holomorphic moment map. I zeta holomorphic moment. So now w zeta phi is going to be given by phi star lambda zeta plus I times v zeta. So this is just a statement about the about 3D and 2D theories, but now this is a useful viewpoint because now I can sort of derive, I can sort of, this gives me all the BPS objects in sort of one shot. And how does it do that? So now there's a four-tier hierarchy of BPS objects. So the first one you can guess is just vacua, which are critical points of mu, or also the fixed points of V. So the usual assumptions about massiveness plus an additional assumption. The additional assumption has to do with its nature of its critical points, critical values. The assumption is that these things, so distinct, all critical values are distinct. No three lie on a line, and no four lie on a plane. On a common plane. So these are the vacua. Now, next, the next is what I would call domain walls. So these are by definition, I sort of map the zeta to the corresponding point in the unit 2 sphere. So an N domain wall, or a zeta domain wall, is a critical point of W zeta. So what this really is, so now what I've done is that I've gotten, so what's the equation? This is an equation from R to Z. It's the gradient flow equation for N1 mu1 plus N2 mu2 plus N3 mu3. So what I've really done is I've sort of gotten the gradient flow equation now as the critical points of a holomorphic function on some space. So there's gradient flow equation. This is what an N-domain wall is. And an N-domain wall is just a gradient flow. But now you can imagine how the next two things will go. Okay, and so the thing I wanted to say was that so this can be written as a gradient flow, but it can also be written as a symplectic or Hamiltonian flow in two different symplectic structures. So in this mu space now, again, I will map to some straight line now. Straight line in this end direction. Right, and so now these things will sort of all have morally the same index because now they're coming from the critical points of a holomorphic function. So there is not much talk about like what's the grade of a domain wall. And so the next I can study sort of a gradient flow or real W. This would give me a map from R2 to Z. And I can sort of contemplate solutions. So this will give me an equation resembling the Witten equation. Witten-Del Bar equation for this thing plays the part of real. So you take this thing and you replace real zeta inverse W with that. And you write it in an appropriate complex structure IN. So now you can contemplate solutions that sort of are junctions of domain walls. So now I'll have a vector space. Because these are now, morally speaking, solid BPS solitons for which I expect to give me graded vector spaces. There's this space. And so the final thing that you can imagine now is that I can study now. So finally, I can study the Witten Del Bar equation, or W zeta. So this would give me an equation that looks like some deformation, some massive deformation of the Schuder equation. Equals. What kind of solutions can I study? Well, because of all this genericity assumptions, I can study solutions that sort of look like intersections, intersecting domain wall junctions, or BPS polytopes. Where I sort of label every edge by a domain wall, and I label every face by a domain wall junction, and then I can sort of look at solutions of this massive Schuder equation, which sort of behaves like this intersection of these domain wall junctions in space-time. And so this, formally at least, you can say there should be some integer. Signed integer of these things. And so the hopeful claim is that there's an algebraic gadget. It's a two-categorical gadget. Into which these things organize. BPS hierarchy organizes. And so that's a good stopping point. I can say more about this if there's some interest. So I have this category, this hierarchy of BPS objects, and I hope that this can be this. There seems to be enough structure that you can sort of combine this into some some structure that looks like a two category. So that's thanks.
Questions for the speaker?
Achoo.
I already asked any questions. Go ahead.
Maybe I missed this, but in three-dimensional setting, you had this hypercolor momentum map, and
yes.
In two dimensions, you didn't have any momentum map.
Yes.
And the reason for this is that you're reducing this 3D supersymmetry to two-dimensional one, right?
What I would say is that in three dimensions, if I want to preserve n equals 4 supersymmetry, I want to sort of deform the theory by some potentials. I think the only choice is that I can deform by some hypercolor moment map. In two dimensions, if I want to preserve 4 supercharges, the analogous statement is that in two dimensions, if I want to preserve n equals 2 comma 2 supersymmetry, I can't just deform by any real function. I have to deform by the real part of some holomorphic function. So it's basically an assumption on, like, if I want a theory that has all the supersymmetries that were there in the theory, in undeformed theory.
So you say that it plays the same role as a potential plate in two dimensions.
Exactly.
In some sense, like in the Morse case, you have functions with one real variable, and here, whatever a holomorphic function is, it's a function to R2.
Yes.
Solving some equations as a function to R3,
yes.
Something having to do with supersymmetry algebra.
Yes.
So
that's like the that's the related three floats. So map to R, map to R, map to R2, map to R3, and then at each level there's some restrictions on a set of allowed maps.
So from that perspective, like, does something change when you go from 3 to 4? Like, I don't know supersymmetry algebra to know what to expect.
Yeah. There are two sort of ways I can interpret your question. One is like, so this is sort of like a RCH.
Yeah, but that might have been a coincidence from, like, it was also an R, R2, R3.
Yes, you're right.
I don't know how to extend the pattern RCH, but I do know how to extend the pattern 1, 2, 3.
Yes, okay. So, yeah, one is about whether there's an R4. The other is whether there's, right? So I think here, to answer your question here, so there is what you would look at. So there's certainly a theory of maps. Let me see.
What I sort of imagined was I could have imagined something like, I'm going to have a manifold with some special geometry, some sort of special geometry on it, and then it'll have to have a map to R4.
Right.
So the hard part is deciding, I guess, what the special geometry that goes, that's after Kähler and hyperkähler.
So as far as sigma models go, I think hyperkähler is the end of the line. Is there an enhanced supersymmetry algebra? Is there some supersymmetric sigma model into that, which has a huge amount of supersymmetry?
More related to supergravity.
Right.
Yeah, it's very well subjected.
I mean, the holonomies, there's some holonomy group, but I forget how, like, in my thinking, like, the sigma models are always, like, in this three-tier hyperkähler, real Kähler, hyperkähler.
There is a 4D sigma model, right?
There is a 4D, yeah. So this is true. So, I mean, so, yeah, yeah. So, so, it's, so what I should have said, So yeah, so let's so there is a definitely a 4D, 5D, 6D sigma model into hypercalar manifold X, into hypercalar manifold Z. This is true. But then
It's always hypercalar. I'm not gonna look for even more.
So okay, so the minimum requirement in 4D is that Kähler. And so in 6D the minimum requirement is hypercalar. I forget what happens in I think here it's also probably Kähler. And for more holonomy, I'm not sure if there's some but so I would argue that the natural continuation is to sort of look for this. And so there the theory you would want to study is essentially unique, and that's 4D n equals 4 gauge theory. With some twist. So that leaves the world of sort of sigma models, but I think so these the fermions here have some sort of structure.
Like you can't deform that thing to make it massive.
You can't, yeah. So I'm just saying that in the 4D n equals 4 there's some three category. And I tend to think of that as sort of the, if there is an upstairs, it's gotta be that. Yeah.
Why do the Octonians have anything to do with 4D n equals 4?
So I don't know the answer of that too well, but I do remember reading something, some statement like this in a book by Chakadi. But I forget the details escape me. I'm not sure. So yeah, it's, if you look at fermions in 10 dimensions, minimally supersymmetric gauge theory in 10 dimensions. Don't they have something like that?
It's the Octonians plus 2.
Right, something like that, yeah.
Is it really Octonians, or is it just going to be some other, like, what was it, an eight that somebody tried to shoehorn into the Octonians?
Probably, yeah. I'm not sure about that. Yeah.
There's some special, like, fierce identities that hold, forget the details, but I think they can be traced to, according to, you know, a blog post by John Baez.
John's the type of person who tries to shoehorn things into the Octonians, and so I'm somehow,
yeah.
Of course, I'm very happy with that if that's what it is. But it's.
Yeah. I mean, so in some sense, like the other perspective is that at each step I double the supersymmetry, right? And
here's another sequence that goes R C H, which is to just take the even subalgebras and Clifford algebras.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing after that is like, and you know, you just, and that sequence goes forever. It just doesn't stay with a long division.
Yeah. But I mean, okay. Like RCH is maybe like not the good thing to see. The good thing, so what I've really done is at each stage I've like increased the dimension and I've doubled the supersymmetry. And if I do that one more time, go to four dimensions, go to a theory with 16 supercharges, I land on something unique. And at each stage the theories get more rare, right? And so that sort of is,
So actually theory's getting rare, like how common is it to have an interesting hyperholomorphic function?
So certainly, of course. I mean, there are plenty of examples. I mean, most of the examples that I know of are like coming from like Higgs branches of gauge theories. I know plenty of examples. That's the only thing I can say. I mean, but I guess you're asking if I give you some hyper.
I don't know any examples, but I wouldn't make a difference into examples, so I don't know.
Yeah, there are. I think there are plenty of examples, right?
It writes in a Kähler manifold.
Well, C2.
You can write in a Kähler manifold.
No, there are like people who study these n equals 4 theories. Definitely, like you know, there's plenty of there's a lot of as far as I know, lots of like. So I mean, okay, if there's some gauge theory with some gauge group G and sort of it acts in some way on some linear space, So then I can take some hypercolor quotient. And so that those sort of gauge theoretic examples give you a way of engineering a large class of them. Yeah.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Hassan again.
Yeah, thanks.